Our next presenter is Phil from is a new title. Unity of Truth, Exegetical Ambiguity, and God's Creation of Humanity from One in Acts 17:26.
Thank you. And I'm going to go ahead and use a script because I always do, and it just keeps me on track. In the book of Acts, in the middle of a speech delivered in Athens, Paul states that from one, God made every nation of humans to dwell on the whole face of the earth. Modern English translations typically render the phrase from one as a reference to one human ancestor. The majority of modern commentators on the passage likewise understand the phrase from one to refer to Adam, and Christian authors who argue against an evolutionary understanding of human origins usually cite this passage as decisive evidence that the Bible teaches that Adam and Eve are humanity's first parents. By contrast, a number of scholars at the intersection of science and faith who build a case for polygenesis omit this passage from their treatments, presumably because it appears to sit uncomfortably alongside polygenism. Though the issue receives no sustained discussion in his recent monograph, this passage appears to constitute a key biblical basis for William Lane Craig's placement of a historical Adam and Eve as the first humans hundreds of thousands of years ago. He says, quote, "Adam is here conceived to be the progenitor of the entire human race on the face of the earth, wherever and whenever people may have lived, not merely someone selected from a wider mass of humanity to fulfill God's calling." It would be ad hoc to try to escape this conclusion by saying that Paul is talking only about people alive at the time, all of whom were a common genealogical ancestor. Paul speaks of people living at all times and places in history and has no concept of modern notions of universal common ancestors discovered by recent science, end quote. Suffice it to say, Paul's comment to the Athenians continues to be consequential in discussions about whether and how scientifically informed Christians should understand a historical Adam and Eve to have existed. It turns out that our passage of interest is sufficiently ambiguous that a handful of different interpretations are exegetically plausible. In this paper, I will briefly introduce five interpretive options and propose that faithful readers of Acts can adjudicate between different options based on the traditional Christian conviction of the unity of truth, i.e. that nature and scripture are God's two books, and rightly understood, these books never contradict each other. One aspect of the ambiguity surrounding from one involves differences in ancient manuscripts. Two viable variants of this phrase can be found in the manuscript tradition. The variant found in the bulk of ancient manuscripts, what we would call the majority text, reads from one blood, whereas the variant that critical scholars generally favor as the earlier version, what we would call the critical text, merely says from one. Although exegetes typically side with the critical text, Fred Cannon has recently argued in favor of the one blood variant and at the least has demonstrated that this should be taken seriously as perhaps the earlier version. Some of the interpretive options I propose are built on the critical text, others on the majority text. In addition to the ambiguity introduced by differences between manuscripts, the meaning of from one in the critical text is ambiguous because the Greek word, translated one, could potentially be masculine or neuter in gender, since in this instance both forms would have identical spelling. In other words, from one could be interpreted to mean from one person or from one thing. If one is taken to be neuter here, it could also potentially be understood to connect to the neuter word nation that appears later in the passage. So from one nation, God made every nation of humans to dwell on the whole face of the earth. The Greek wording of the critical text of our passage adds to the ambiguity of Paul's utterance and thus increases the number of interpretive options that we might consider. I recently published an article in Perspectives on Science and Christian Faith in which I identify five exegetically plausible options for how our phrase of interest might be interpreted. Each option has its strengths and weaknesses, but each is ultimately a reasonable possibility for how this passage might be understood. Rather than repeat the details of my argument here, I will enumerate the options briefly and refer anyone interested in the particulars to that article. The first three options assume the textual variant that appeared in the critical text, namely the variant that says God made every human nation from one without mentioning blood. The most popular option among modern interpreters, which we will call option one, understands that God made every human nation from one human ancestor, Adam. This interpretation would normally presume that Adam and Eve are universal ancestors to all humans in the common era. The second option, seldom suggested by scholars, but nonetheless quite linguistically and thematically plausible, is that God made every human nation from one nation. This could potentially be identified with the biblical account of Babel, which describes the people of Shinar being unified and sharing a common language before they were scattered by God, resulting in the emergence of an elaborate table of nations right after that. The third option, argued by a significant minority of biblical scholars, is that God made every human nation from one divine source, whereas the first two interpretations would see Paul's words at this point in his speech as an allusion to the Jewish scriptures. This option understands Paul to evoke Stoic philosophical traditions about the equality of humanity based on the origination of all humans from the divine. A typical biblically informed Jewish perspective would certainly agree that God is the single divine source of all human nations. So this interpretation could be seen as Paul establishing common ground between his own worldview and that of his Athenian intellectual audience. The last two options assume the textual variant of the majority text, namely from one blood. Option four understands God's creation of all human nations from one blood communally. In other words, all people groups descend from a single primordial population. In a sense, then, this option parallels option two. That's the from one nation option. And finally, option five parallels option one. Under this understanding, God's creation of every human nation from one blood refers to the single bloodline of Adam. This interpretation has roughly the same strengths and weaknesses as option one. And I should mention, when scholars talk about what was meant by from one blood, even if they don't consider that the original reading, that's usually how they identify what they thought that was supposed to mean. If I had to pick one of these options as my preference, I would choose option three, since this is the only option of the five that aligns fully with Paul's general strategy in his speech to the Athenians. Whereas many of the speeches of Acts are delivered to Jewish and Jewish-adjacent audiences and assume a broadly Jewish worldview, including numerous allusions to Jewish scriptures, Paul's address to the Athenians avoids overt scriptural references and instead evokes Athenian poets, Athenian devotional objects, and Athenian, especially Stoic, sensibilities about the divine. Up to the point where Paul mentions Jesus' resurrection from the dead, eliciting scoffing from some of his auditors, one can imagine those gathered nodding their heads in recognition as he describes the God he is proclaiming. Options 1, 2, 4, and 5 all represent concepts that would potentially be meaningful to the implied Christian readers of Acts, who are presumably familiar with the Jewish scriptures, but they do not involve concepts that would be rhetorically compelling to Paul's Athenian intellectual audience. That said, a plausible exegetical case can be made for all the options I have enumerated. The meaning of the phrase from one or from one blood in this passage is genuinely ambiguous. Furthermore, if some amazing new manuscript evidence were discovered that settled the text critical question in favor of the from one blood reading, this would rule out the from one source interpretation as a viable way of understanding the passage. Multiple understandings of Paul's reference to God's making the nations from one are reasonable on exegetical and text critical grounds. However, for the purposes of normative Christian interpretation, the options are not equally congenial to all scientific understandings of human origins. The Adamic interpretations, options 1 and 5, would require a historical Adam and Eve. Indeed, Adam and Eve would not just have to be historical, but would seemingly need to be singular or at least special progenitors of all human nations. The one nation interpretation, option 2, would require one nation from which all other nations descend. One could perhaps work with a loose definition of nation and understand this option in reference to an evolving population of human ancestors rather than an organized society, but the human ancestral population likely lived in small scattered groups among which individuals migrated from time to time, and it seems to be a stretch to call this a singular nation. Further, if one takes Paul's one nation to refer to universal descent from the group of primordial humans described in the Babel narrative of Genesis, there are additional critical problems with this story that would need to be addressed. The communal interpretation of one blood, option 4, lends itself more readily to an evolutionary understanding of human origins than does the one nation version, since one blood is more vague. However, if we understand Paul to have in mind something other than the group of people from the Babel account or the particular bloodline of Adam and Eve, then it is not apparent what he does have in mind, And presumably we can't reasonably imagine that Paul or Luke intended to describe the evolving population of scattered groups reconstructed by modern science. Finally, the interpretation of that humans were made from one divine source, option three, works quite well vis-a-vis any account I have heard of evolutionary creation, though, of course, we should be careful not to interpret Paul in an overtly stoic way that ignores his uniqueness as a proclaimer of the gospel of Christ. Given that our passage presents us with a number of interpretive options that cohere to varying degrees with a critical scientific perspective, how might we adjudicate between them? The Christian tradition does not present us with a definitive answer to how such issues ought to be resolved, but insofar as a relevant thread of tradition can be found, potential conflicts between the Bible and science, or natural philosophy, as the predecessor to modern science, have been addressed using the theological conviction of the unity of truth. In other words, nature and scripture are held to be God's two books, which each reveal God's truth in unique ways, but which, properly understood, cannot contradict one another, since both come from the one supreme God. As Kenneth J. Howe has shown, the strategies that have been adopted for reconciling God's two books vary greatly across situations, but the varied strategies are rooted in the shared core conviction that the natural world and faith can and should be reconciled in the rare case where they appear to conflict. For example, in the case of the Copernican Revolution, both Galileo and his key interlocutors agreed on the unity of truth and agreed that if the heliocentric model were proven indubitably, then biblical interpretation would need to be updated to correspond to nature. They disagreed primarily on the extent to which the heliocentric model was demonstrable. More specifically, Richard J. Blackwell shows that both Galileo and Cardinal Robert Bellarmine, who confronted Galileo on behalf of the Roman Catholic Church regarding heliocentrism, seem to have presumed that scientific propositions that appear to conflict with Scripture could be placed into one of three meaningful categories, and this is all a quote. Category one, propositions demonstrated to be true. Category two, propositions not demonstrated to date, but which could be demonstrated in the future. And category three, propositions that can never be conclusively proven to be true, end quote. Both Galileo and Bellarmine agreed that issues in category one necessitate a reinterpretation of Scripture, or at least an acknowledgement of ignorance in how to interpret problematic passages correctly. If a claim about the natural world is indubitably true, biblical interpretation must bend to accommodate this truth. Both apparently also agreed that issues in Category 3 should not prompt a reinterpretation of Scripture or Christian faith. Rather, our understanding of nature should bend to accommodate the Bible. Galileo's discussion of issues in Category 2 is not always clearly consistent, but he generally agrees that the meaning of the Bible should not be fixed in the face of issues in Category 2. Further, he apparently regarded heliocentrism as an issue in Category 2, that is, provable but not yet definitively proven in his day. And history has, of course, vindicated this view. By contrast, it seems that Bellarmine may have placed heliocentrism in Category 3, i.e. not ever provable, and thus insisted that the Bible should trump natural philosophy on the matter. As a biblical scholar with minimal training in biology, I am not qualified to determine the extent to which we can be scientifically certain of polygenesis or monogenesis. For that matter, written records pertaining to Galileo and Bellarmine do not establish specific criteria for determining how to categorize a particular scientific claim in terms of certainty. Moreover, it is not a given that Galileo, Bellarmine, or any other individual in the history of interpretation should get to decide how modern Christians ought to adjudicate between Scripture and science, not least because, as Blackwell notes, biblical truth has was generally regarded as superior to scientific truth in the cultural milieu of Galileo and Bellarmine, whereas scientific truth is typically regarded as superior to biblical truth in much of modern Western culture. Furthermore, even if one is thoroughly convinced of their specific understanding of human origins, it would not be correct to say that any of the mainstream options contradicts Acts, since Paul's comment about the origin of human nations can reasonably be interpreted in multiple ways. To say the least, the question of how to interpret this passage in the face of science is less than straightforward. At best, my suggestion along these lines are provisional and invite further constructive discourse. So then, I submit that the following elements should characterize a faithful and scientifically informed approach to Acts 17:26. First, the subject should be confronted and discussed. Those treatments of evolutionary creation that conveniently ignore this passage are overlooking an important aspect of the biblical material relevant to human origins. My discussion should deprecate any scandal associated with this passage for evolutionary creationists, since the passage does not necessarily demand a monogenetic understanding of human origins. Second, the range of plausible interpretations should be acknowledged. In all likelihood, most readers of Acts in English assume that the text must refer to human descent from Adam, given the consistency with which modern English translations render our phrase in reference to one ancestor. To raise awareness about this interpretive flexibility is to give more people the chance to have insightful thoughts about it. Third, to the extent that polygenism is affirmed with confidence, plausible interpretations consistent with polygenism should be favored with corresponding conviction over those that imply monogenism. This is not to say that science should dictate all aspects of biblical interpretation. Such an approach makes scripture subordinate to nature. The case of Acts 17:26 is particular in that multiple reasonable interpretations can be found, some of which cohere with scientific consensus and others which are potentially problematized by science. Attempting to generalize the hermeneutical implications of my particular discussion of Acts 17, we might say that both science as the interpretation of nature and exegesis as the interpretation of scripture involve degrees of confidence. In Galileo's day, heliocentrism had not yet been demonstrated definitively, though there were good observational reasons for natural philosophers to think it was true. In the 21st century, scarcely anyone would question that the earth revolves around the sun. Galileo's discussion of biblical interpretation involved a certain tentativeness, since he expected heliocentrism would be proven in the future relative to his day. His argument was not that biblical interpretation should be revised based on what he thought would be proven eventually, but rather that the church's interpretation should not be fixed on geocentric assumptions while the issue was unresolved. Analogously, biblical interpretation could also be said to involve degrees of confidence. Some elements of scripture are pervasively agreed upon, whereas others are exegetically controversial and cause a great deal of ink to be spilled in the course of scholarly interlocution. Furthermore, we could reasonably say that neither science nor exegesis is ever finished. The possibility always exists that a new scientific discovery will require a revision of an entrenched consensus, and likewise, on occasion, a striking exegetical argument changes an axiom in biblical interpretation. A salient example would be E.P. Sanders' Paul and Palestinian Judaism, which caused a massive shift in how Paul was understood to engage first century Jewish interpretation of the Torah. We could consider a general principle that a strongly evidenced scientific consensus should take a certain kind of hermeneutical priority over a biblical passage with multiple plausible interpretations, whereas a strongly held consensus about biblical interpretation should be maintained in the face of less than definitive scientific controversies. In some circumstances, definitive interpretation may need to be deferred until greater exegetical or scientific clarity can be reached. Such a principle seems to me a fair application of the concept of the unity of truth. I presume that new discoveries could potentially lead to a firm consensus for or against the existence of a historical Adam from whom all human nations descend. Insofar as such an Adam is ruled out, it should prompt faithful Christian interpreters of Acts to disregard the Adamic interpretation of the passage in favor of better options. Likewise, it is perhaps possible that a new brilliant exegete may come along with an insight that will settle the interpretation of this biblical passage in such a way that polygenism cannot reasonably be accepted by faithful Christians, though, admittedly, this sort of consensus among biblical interpreters is pretty rare. For that matter, amazing new manuscript discoveries could potentially settle the text critical ambiguity around our passage in favor of from one blood, or some as yet unknown variant that would affect the range of plausible interpretive options. It has recently come to my attention that in science and faith conversations, the question of polygenesis versus monogenesis is far from settled. Whereas some discussion in this passage has pressed firmly in favor of polygenesis for a number of years, Joshua Swamidas has recently presented a compelling case that our current science does not rule out a recent Adam and Eve as universal genealogical ancestors. And William Lane Craig's recent monograph argues that Christians should understand Adam and Eve as very early exclusive ancestors of modern humans. Insofar as the question of common descent from Adam and Eve is not currently settled, we would do well to keep the range of interpretive possibilities open, much as Galileo urged the church of his day to avoid locking down a geocentric interpretation of certain biblical passages. People are often more comfortable with biblical, theological, and religious certainty, but faithfully interpreting God's two books means that in certain cases, we need to embrace ambiguity. Thank you.
Any questions?
I have one. I'm just point of view, could you in one sentence kind of tell you why the first part of Act 7 and 6 is so controversial to you?
The normal interpretation of this passage says that all humans are descended from Adam, and by extension we would say Adam and Eve from one common couple. The conventional scientific view is that that is not the evolutionary story. And so insofar as those don't match up, it potentially makes the passage scandalous to people who want to take the scientific perspective seriously. I can say more if you'd like, but that, if you want a short answer, that'd be my answer.
Matthew.
Yeah, thanks for that. When I hear the word collisionism, often I get a little uncomfortable. I start thinking about a sort of history in which people like Louis Agassiz posited separate centers of creation where some humans are in the image of God because they were made over here and descended from Adam, and other humans were actually not descended from Adam. They were made over here and are genealogically not connected at all. So there's sort of a messy history there with that term. But you don't seem to be using collisionism in the same sort of way as that. So it's only if you
I don't think anyone uses the term to posit something like that in this century.
No, but it's just a term that I haven't heard in the context that you're using. And probably because
I certainly have seen a lot of literature that uses it the way I'm using it. So
yeah,
okay. While the history of the term is potentially problematic, it's not the term, right? It's the idea
that
humans are multiple different, whatever. Some humans are more human than others, which certainly is not what I'm suggesting. And at least in the places where I've seen the term be used recently, it's used just to mean not one single couple is the common ancestor of everything.
Yeah. Thank you so much. This was very helpful. One option that I've seen is, I believe it's titled, well, you can correct me, is sort of like a 1B, which is that from one man, that's referencing Noah.
Oh, yeah, this one.
Yeah. I don't know if that has any popularity or any support. I just want to hear your comments on that.
I mean, a lot of people have read Walton, so I'm sure it's out there. I'm trying to remember exactly how I dismissed this in my article. I know I dismissed it in a footnote. But I think it doesn't. I don't think it solves anything. He's trying to say you can get rid of the Adam scandal by saying it's Noah instead. But I mean, everyone being descended from Noah is just as thorny, I think, you know, as everyone being descended from Adam. So it doesn't seem to me like it really solves a problem. Part of his argument is that there. Some of the elements of Paul's speech that could be linked to Scripture link not to the creation account. Well, some of them maybe do link to the creation account in Genesis, but there's stuff that specifically aligns with things right around that kind of the human spreading after the flood, which I think would be a good case if you're trying to advocate the Babel interpretation. I think it supports the Babel interpretation better than it supports Noah per se. But if you like Noah better than Adam, I mean, yes, I guess it could work, but it still, you know, doesn't. I don't think it helps you with science and Scripture and reconciling these issues. But yeah, it's an argument that's out there.
Awesome, thank you.
So, what do you think Paul meant or Luke,
right,
when they spoke these words?
Sure. Gun to my head, if I had to pick one, I'd go option three. That is that he's talking about God making all nations from one source, and that source is ultimately God, the source of everything.
Do you think Paul and Luke believed in sort of the monophyletic origins?
Well, under that interpretation, the passage doesn't comment on, monophyletic origins or anything like that. It would just be talking about. It wouldn't be talking about descent and patterns of descent at all.
Okay, so apart from this passage, though.
I assume if you asked Paul, do you think all humans descended from Adam and Eve, he would probably say yes. I don't know what else he would have thought. you know, certainly wouldn't have thought that we all evolved from lower species or something. So presumably that's what he would, how he would answer, I would have to assume. But just because he thought that doesn't mean he said that here. And I do think that matters.
That's fair.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. But one is, do you know Michael Heiser has anything to say about or contribute to this discussion?
I'm not familiar.
So he's a biblical. Oh, he's also at Lyons Walton. He talks about ancient texts. And I was wondering if you found anything about him. But I guess
I haven't read it.
Second thing is, so you mentioned Galileo. And you mentioned that he's, I think what you said, I totally said you correctly, that you can use science to, in a sense, to help us interpret scripture.
I think it was less that he wanted to advocate always looking to science to understand scripture. It's more that when you reach these, you know, an impasse where the science appears to say one thing and scripture appears to say something else, that, you know, the question is how to reconcile those two things. And Galileo was drawing from St. Augustine, who did something similar quite a few centuries earlier, when a certain set of Christians were advocating for like the snow globe model of the earth or something, a snow globe cosmology based on that you could, you know, Genesis could sound like that. Whereas the conventional understanding in that context was that the sky is made of air and the earth is a sphere, and that had been known for many centuries. So Augustine was basically saying, relax, you know, you're making yourself and all of us look silly by saying that the earth is a snow globe when we know we have lots of good reasons to believe in, you know, something closer to the model that we have now, I guess. And so Augustine was making a case for, here's, you know, the principles that should be applied to reconciling God's two books if they seem to say two different things. And so Galileo was then pretty much recapitulating that argument and applying it to.
Because I also know he mentioned he also made another assertion to say that scripture also may not be focused on science at all. And he also said the apostles themselves are not focused with science, they're focused on things of faith. So
he did say that as well, but there was still acknowledgement that, like, once in a while.
Yeah.
There are these conflicts. I mean, of course, that was what prompted the whole discussion for him, was he was saying something that the church said was unbiblical and theologically wrong. So while, yeah, you shouldn't, the point was not go to science to interpret the Bible, or neither was it go to the Bible to figure out your science. When there's an issue that comes up, and occasionally issues do come up, how do we navigate that? And that's really the issue.
Really well articulated. I really, really liked your
talk. Thank you.
And so my question is, and I think this is not what you're saying, but if there was one thing that's the most tempting for you to place a literal Adam and Eve of a sort, even a genealogical one, within the history of humanity, what would that be? Is it, you know, like, a common idea, of course, is the transfer of some sort of image of God, it's yours, you know, and so is there any kind of idea that you'd say, you know, that would actually be very nice, other than perhaps simply the convenience of its explanatory power?
I'm not 100% sure I've caught the question, so tell me if I get it wrong. I would say that when I read Romans 5, it does appear to me that Paul is saying that Adam, one man, had an impact on the rest of humanity. So that does make me want to say there's a historical Adam. It doesn't make me insist on a universal progenitor, you know, Adam and Eve as the people who gave rise to everyone else necessarily. I'm not prepared to say that wasn't true either. My reading of scripture doesn't require that as I understand it currently. So, but I do like the idea that there's a real person, that this isn't just a metaphor for how we all are with respect to God's commands or something like that, though there are people who advocate that view.
So you would say that there you think there was at one point a literal Adam, although Acts 17:26 is really not Adam.
Right, yeah. So this paper would be concerned with what the passage is about. Now, if the passage is doing my preferred interpretation, the sort of stoically rooted one, the passage doesn't comment on it. But yeah, Paul seems to me to talk about Adam as an actual person who had actual, his actions had consequences for others. And so that does make me, I'm reluctant to give that up. You can make a case for that, you know, plenty of books have suggested that you can do something non-literal with that so that there wasn't a historical Adam. I'm not saying I have, you know, if there was, I have no way to prove it, but, I kind of want, if I'm preaching a sermon, I'm thinking of there being an actual Adam and Eve in some capacity, sometime. Mm-hmm. I don't know whose parents they are. I don't know, you know, how they got there. I'm trying to stay in my lane and read Bible passages and say what I see there. So, but it does sound like, we'd almost have to say Paul was wrong in Romans if there was no historical Adam. So I kind of want there to be. I don't know if that addresses your question.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's a model that I don't think was directly addressed that I first saw by Catholic writer Kenneth Kent, where he proposed that we could have a population of hominids. God selects two individuals, endows them with the image of God, the capacity to interact with spiritually with the creator, and that they continue to have people that look like them, or not people, just hominids around them that look like them. They are set aside, set apart, they disobey, they have sexual interactions with them that insert genetic, additional genetic material into that line, so that you could in fact have a lineage where all of us do lead back to that first selected couple, while also having genetic diversity from those illicit relationships.
Right.
Is that something that you've interacted with at all?
It's not something that I've read it, I'm aware of it. I don't think it bears on how I'm interpreting the passage per se, but it would be an example of, I'm not the science expert in the room, if we'll allow that science doesn't contradict his view, which my understanding is it probably doesn't. Then it's something that we might consider. And I suppose you could take the traditional interpretation of the passage, the Adam reading, and I think that works. So as long as there's something special about Adam and Eve that God is making everyone from one, that kind of works for me as a. If it turns out to be true, then you could reconcile it with the Adam, you know, options one or five that I had up there earlier. I'm not sure if I think that's the right way to look at it or not, but it would be, yeah, it's one of the reasons that I guess I wouldn't want to say at this point that we can rule out the Adam interpretation of the passage, that the science isn't totally on one side or the other.
Thank you, Bill. That was very interesting.